This is an ABC podcast.
This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
And a very good afternoon to you. Today, the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority has suspended the product registration of dimethoate for the use on blueberries, raspberries and blackberries. And it was really triggered, this review, by the increasing consumption of berries that we're consuming right across the country. And so the APVMA thought it better have a closer look at this particular pesticide that's used quite commonly in the berry industry. So we'll catch up with the chair of Berries Australia, Anthony Poyner, who's, well, he's had to accept the decision, really, but I guess if he had his way, he'd much rather continue using that pesticide into the future. But he does have to accept the umpire's decision. We'll hear more from him shortly. And also a little later in the hour, just after the news headlines at 12:30 today, the Department of Lands is expected to roll out new pastoral lease conditions next year. And this is under a plan to modernise the state's pastoral leases. And Ashley Dowden, who's chair of the PGA's pastoral committee, says they have sort of been negotiating with the department and have come to some sort of resolutions with concerns that the pastoralists have. But there still are a couple of things on the agenda they really want ironed out before those details are finalised. Ashley Dowden along just after the news headlines at 12:30. 12:07 here on the Country Hour on the ABC right across Western Australia. First up today, plans for another large-scale wind farm in Western Australia's wheat belt have been revealed, and this time at Dandaragan, 160 kilometres north of Perth. Alinta has lodged the proposal to the Environmental Protection Authority to build the 82-turbine Marri wind farm, with further plans for a big battery storage system. The wind farm would generate about 550 megawatts of renewable energy. And to put that into perspective, that's about 10% of the current demand for electricity through the South West interconnected system. Dandaragan Shire President Tony O'Gorman says most of the community is on board with Alinta's plans.
I think generally we have great acceptance of these renewable programs in our shire. It provides a supplementary income to our farmers, and that's great for them, particularly if they have a bad year. But also what they manage to do is keep grazing underneath in and around the renewable energy projects, which is great for them as well. So while they're leasing their land off, they still actually have use of that land in most cases. And then they can actually graze their cattle or sheep underneath the renewable energy infrastructure.
It's a big wind farm, and it's one of many that are looking at your shire to come into the area. What's the value, Tony, of the projects that are in the pipeline?
Look, we're looking at $9 billion worth of projects over the next 8 to 10 years. We've got 3 wind farms and 2 solar farms in our shire at the moment. And I know we've got quite a number on our planning books into the future. We've got Waddy. We've got Parran Wind Farm, which is imminently about to start construction. We've got Marri, just to name 3 of them off the top of my head. But yes, we've got quite a lot coming into the area. I think principally because we have, as anybody who's ever travelled through the Shire of Dandaragan knows, particularly around the coastal areas, we've got plenty of wind and it's fairly consistent, particularly in the summer months as well. So, you know, it's really good for that natural resource. Plus, we have the high voltage lines running right through the middle of our Shire so that all these renewable energy projects are able to connect in reasonably readily. That's a relatively new high voltage line that's gone through in the last 5 or 6 years. So it makes it, you know, very attractive for these renewable energy projects to come into our shire.
One of the other things that is potentially planned with a Marri wind farm is a 6,600 megawatt hour battery energy storage system, which people probably know as a BESS. Now, that is a really big battery that's potentially also coming into your region. Does that change the landscape for you when you think about renewables and community benefit?
Renewables have been around in the Shire of Dendarrigan since, I think, about 2006. The Emu Downs wind farm was the first one to come into our community. Since that, we've learned a lot. And what we've learned is what we should be asking for when these projects are coming to town, so to speak. What we actually impress upon on the proponents when they apply for planning permission or planning approval, development approval, is that they, one, construct the road in bitumen, particularly the construction roads. That way they don't have to continuously repair the roads as they're bringing in these big wind turbines. The other thing that we've negotiated, or we've talked to we've been negotiating with the proponents, is about a local area connection. You know, we generate the power in the Shire of Dendarrigan, it gets sent into the Swiss, and it eventually comes back to us. What we've been talking to Powering WA and Western Power about is actually having a local takeoff so that we have stable electricity supply within our Shire. Stable energy supply is critical for us, and that's what we're we ask about all the time, and we try to negotiate that into the proponents' deals. We can't actually force them to do it, but we do raise it, and it's one of the things that would be super beneficial to our community.
And with this wind farm, this latest one that's coming in, the Murray, and the other proposals that are more advanced in the Shire, do you also negotiate a fee per megawatt generated or anything like that?
In the Yandon wind farm, we get approximately $60,000 a year as a community benefit fund. And in fact, that has just closed, and it's about to be decided in the next couple of weeks, the beneficiaries of that. The Perrin wind farm, which has development approval and construction is imminent, have proposed $1,000 per megawatt, which equates to about $17.5 million over the life of the wind farm. We're proposing that the local government is a beneficiary of that, and that we can make sure that legacy projects are constructed from that.
And Tony, does that set the standard, that $1,000 that you've negotiated with Perrin per megawatt, does that set the standard for other projects, say for this latest one, this Alinta project with Murray? Is that what you'd be asking for?
Well, I think that's the minimum that we should be asking for. There isn't a rate at the moment. There's a suggested rate through the state government. But what we've looked at is Eastern States and what the Clean Energy Council has put up as a base rate, or as a, you know, an acceptable rate that actually benefits the local community. And I have to say, Tim Stevenson from Power and Wind Farms has been very accommodating in that. And, you know, he's very, I suppose you could call it, attentive to our local area, because he is from our local area. You know, he's a farmer out near Badgingarra. He understands the impacts of having these renewable energy projects in your backyard, and he understands the compensation that's due to the community.
Dendarrigan Shire President Tony O'Gorman speaking to Joe Prendergast about that new large-scale wind farm for WA's Wheat Belt. It's a proposal at this stage. The details of that have just been revealed, and this time at Dendarrigan, 160 kilometres north of Perth. It's called the Murray Wind Farm. And as Tony was saying, those plans are just one of many renewable energy projects in the pipeline for this shire, with $9 billion worth of projects potentially being built. And that proposal from Alinta is on the Environmental Protection Authority website, and it has a public comment period of 7 days if you're interested to have your say. And I wonder, I mean, Tony was so positive about the plans for this particular proposal, the Murray Wind Farm, and he says the community feels the same way. And I wonder what's been the reaction to wind farm proposals in your community. Is it just as positive as what Tony and the community think around Dendarrigan, or different? Where you are, let me know on the text 0448 922 604, 14 past 12. Well, as you just heard, Alinta is eyeing the economics behind building a very large battery at its Murray Wind Farm to store electricity, and it's not alone. The Clean Energy Council says there are more than 30 grid-scale batteries in Australia, and many more in the pipeline. A key question in energy circles, though, is whether enough grid-scale batteries can be built in time to provide reliable and stable power. Australia has some of the biggest sources of lithium, nickel and vanadium, which are crucial to battery production. Professor Neeraj Sharma from the University of New South Wales says researchers are looking at how Australia can get more value from the global battery manufacturing boom. And he also says it's a challenge to create batteries that can supply the grids for long durations.
You have batteries that are tailored for load leveling. You have batteries that are tailored for household storage. You have batteries that are tailored for large-scale solar, right? So we do have that. The question is, and I guess the challenges and the things that we're sort of working towards is, do you have that solution for 2 hours, 3 hours, 2 days, 5 days? And what does that look like? I think that's the big question. And if we can solve that, then we can actually go fossil fuel free and energy will be from sunshine and from storage systems.
Now, the lithium sector in Australia, if we go back, you know, in terms of the supply chain, right, we have a large part of the lithium supply, but the industry has been knocked about by Chinese intervention in the market. So what do you think of the prospects of Australia becoming self-reliant when it comes to lithium batteries? Because at the moment, we're just exporting that raw material, aren't we?
We are. And look, we've been working, the researchers, industry have been trying to do this and look at ways in which we can actually access more of the value chain, battery value chain, whether it's minerals processing, electrode making, cell manufacturer, rather than just mining and selling. Can we do more of the processing? Can we do more of the next generation technologies? What does that look like? And so it's an exciting space to be in. It's a very competitive space to be in. And it's the question of how do we fit into that world? I mean, and then we sort of need to do it quite quickly, rapidly.
Well, that's what the government's thinking about, isn't it, when it puts up some of these policies to support critical minerals investment and the US at the same time. But another pathway for Australia is to work with other countries like third parties, because China dominates in the downstream processing side, the battery side. Could we work effectively with Indonesia, for example, where they're also doing some downstream processing? There's a lot of Australian companies involved in mining resources there, but processing them as well. They've got a free trade agreement with Europe. Could that be a really good avenue for Australia to develop some of that capacity along with Indonesia?
I think it's a worldwide market. It just depends on how we can actually translate some of the technologies we're developing. And also, do we need a massive gigafactory here? I would say yes, that would be fantastic.
A gigafactory, did you say?
Yeah. Do we need a gigafactory here in Australia? Yes, that would be fantastic. We're ideally suited for it. You know, if we can actually power that with solar, it's an ideal place to have a gigafactory. But what does that look like? What does that footprint look like? Are we going to have enough production? There's a lot of questions associated with that. But if there's a vision, that might be possible.
If you look back at the last 10 years in battery development, you know, the increase in the amount of power, you know, that can be generated and stored in batteries has been massive. The global lithium production's skyrocketed 8 times. Yep. So what do you think the next 10 years looks like?
That's a very good question. I think what's going to happen in the next 10 years is you're going to have lithium ion batteries actually being the norm for electric vehicles and household storage. You're going to probably see sodium-ion batteries coming in for the grid scale and potentially even the household storage space. And then some next-generation batteries probably kicking in, say, lithium sulfur or solid state for more specialized sort of high-energy applications, say, drones or sort of trucks and things like this. And then potentially some vanadium redox batteries for the mid- to long-range storage on the grid.
So there's a lot of battery projects that are slated for regional areas. Do you think that there are risks and opportunities in having a battery in a regional area?
I think it's a fantastic opportunity. There are risks in terms of training, in terms of resourcing and things like this, but I think with current technology, it's fantastic having it in a regional space, whether it is actual battery or it's a battery processing or manufacturing or equipment or parts thing, having that in regional Australia is brilliant.
What can you bolt onto that? You know, if you've got a big battery, grid scale battery in your area, can you power, you know, industry off the back of that?
Yeah, that's the whole idea. You would then be able to get lower energy for your industry that works in the area. So if you're looking at processing of primary goods and stuff like this, you can really start to think about how you lower that cost, makes it much more competitive in the international market. things like this, right? So, you know, there's an opportunity here to be innovative, an opportunity to be sort of leading the world in how we transition and how we actually utilize storage coupled with generation, coupled with local industries.
Professor Neeraj Sharma from the University of New South Wales, he was speaking to David Claughton. And Professor Sharma is currently an associate professor working on the chemistry of solid-state batteries and also won the New South Wales Premier's Prize for Science and Engineering in 2019. 20 past 12, a few texts through on the wind farm, and in particular the one we spoke about a few moments ago, plans for that large-scale wind farm in WA's Wheatbelt in Dandaragan. Alinta has lodged the proposal to the Environmental Protection Authority to build this 82-turbine Marie wind farm with future plans for a big battery storage system. And Tony O'Gorman, the Dandaragan Shire President, pretty happy about the plans, what he's seen of it so far. This on the text from Mark, who's also in Dandaragan. He says, the question has to be asked about this new wind farm. Would it ever turn a profit if it didn't receive government subsidies setting it up and going forward? We must know all the facts about the life of the turbines and how much money it is costing us in subsidies. Thank you for that, Mark. And Jim says, just like we have ships of petroleum and gas, is there such a thing as a battery-powered storage ship that can charge up in WA and then sail to Indonesia or somewhere that needs our power and then discharge it to their battery bank? I don't know, Jim. 0448 922 604, text through and be part of the conversation today. 21 past 12.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
The Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority has suspended the product registration of dimethoate for use on blueberries, raspberries and blackberries. A surge in the consumption of these berries was the catalyst to the APVMA review into the popular pesticide that's used to kill fruit fly. Anthony Poyner is chair of Berries Australia and says the new 14-day withholding period for dimethoate means the chemical can't be used during harvest, and the industry is going to have to look at alternative management practices. He says the industry must accept the umpire's decision.
Well, my first reaction is I accept it completely. Secondly, you know, I'm very supportive of their focus on ensuring that as our industries evolve, they make sure that they're custodians of keeping consumers safe. So I think that's great, and they're doing their job, so that's good. And particularly in the context of people are eating so many more blueberries, so it's appropriate to look at it. So, you know, I just think, you know, we support their findings. What I don't have is the detail of the research behind, you know, where they landed. Dimethoate's a very unstable compound chemically, so I'm very keen to have a look and see what their research was and how they landed at this decision.
Last time we spoke, you said that if it is suspended in that particular use case, that basically it wouldn't be effective or be able to be used because you're picking berries every 2-3 days and having a longer withholding period basically renders it useless. Is that still your view?
Yeah, we won't be able to use dimethoate in harvest season. No, we won't, because, you know, we would harvest on a cycle of about every 7 days, but the withholding period is 14. So we won't be able to apply that during harvest season, no.
And last time you spoke, you said that it would increase costs for growers and potentially for consumers.
Well, dimethoate is very effective against fruit fly, very. It's the most effective tool. But we do use integrated management to control fruit fly. So we will have one less tool in the armour in harvest season without dimethoate, but we'll buckle down and use all of our brilliant agronomists to come up with what the best integrated strategies are going to be.
Is this decision going to cost growers and consumers?
Well, on its face, if we don't do anything about it, yes. But we'll now apply our minds to adjust our integrated strategies and try and mitigate that.
Yeah, last time we spoke, you were pretty strong on that particular line.
And I remain of the same point. Mm. I was hopeful Look, I don't have access to the research that the APVMA drew from.
I'm just thinking, consumers in the supermarket are thinking, well, am I going to pay an extra $1 or $2 a punnet or am I not?
No, not that much. And look, we're applying new thinking all the time, particularly in pest management. And so, look, the effort has to be accept the quality of what APVMA do, accept their outcome, and put our shoulder to the wheel of how we can best control Queensland fruit fly. That has to be the approach we adopt now. Yeah. We use assassin bugs. We can use different chemicals in, you know, outside of harvest period. We've got a lot of practices in field. It's a pretty fascinating area of science with quite a lot of effort going into it.
The discussion we had in the lead up to them considering it was a bit more robust.
I wanted to highlight the fact that with a 14-day withholding period for dimethylase, that will mean we cannot use it in harvest season. That is true, but life moves on, and I do respect the APVMA and do respect their findings. I think they would have taken on board my input, which was what we spoke about before, that will render dimethylate unusable in harvest season. I'm sure they'll have listened to that. I'm sure of it. I'm sure they'll have taken the fact that the evolution of how much people are eating blueberries, they'll have taken that into account, and they'll have taken into account the fact that they're going to want to be very, 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 very sure that consumers are safe.
So how's the future of the blueberry industry looking without this key chemical in harvest period?
Look, I'm very optimistic about the future of the industry. We have a huge amount of innovation, you know, a lot of really capable people in our industry. And so when changes like this come along, we take it on and we embrace it and we find new solutions. So I can't tell you exactly what they're going to be right now. But I'm optimistic that we've got a very vibrant industry with a lot of really good minds at work in a good way. I'm very optimistic. I wish we could still use dimethylase, but I accept what the APVMA have come out with. But I don't wish to use it, given what they've come out with. Mm. I don't wish to use it now, but I would obviously have liked a very effective chemical to be able to apply in the mix of IPN. I think we're going to have to stay alive to this because the decision has been won for the next 12 months. So I think we've got work to do over the next 12 months to work out the best solutions. Their actual decision was that there were certain products that are no longer registered. And then secondly, for the next 12 months, we can use certain products with a 14-day withholding period. So that's a next 12-month decision. So we've got plenty of work to do.
Anthony Poyner, he's chair of Berries Australia. He was speaking to Brandon Long. Under the new guidelines, berry growers can continue to use dimethylate under a temporary one-year permit with a 14-day harvest withholding period. And the APVMA says berries are still safe to eat. 28 past 12. Kate Warren runs a spray-free patch at Lorien Blueberry Farm in the southwest. She welcomes the APVMA's decision.
I think personally anything that reduces the chemicals in our food is a good thing. I mean, I guess that's their job, isn't it, to make sure that it's healthy and we're not consuming things that we don't need to be. So I think it's a good thing, but for the farmers out there that are using it, I think they're going to need to offer some sort of alternative.
This chemical is mainly used to tackle Queensland fruit fly, which we haven't had in our state since the end of 2024. Do you think this suspension has been a long time coming in your view?
I just think more consumers are waking up, so they're starting to realise, you know, what is being sprayed in our food, and then also the uptake in berry eating, like the amount of people that are eating blueberries now. And blueberries, when I was a kid, was like a really special treat, and now most parents are filling lunchboxes full of blueberries.
Do you think, though, people who use the chemical might be concerned about what they'll do if this Queensland fruit fly does come back to WA?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's something that I have to assess if it did come back to WA. We're pretty strict with our border control, but they need to have some sort of alternative. You can't just ban something and then not have an alternative for it.
And you've said that you don't use dimethylate on your farm. What do you guys use instead?
So we're really lucky, actually, because we're right in the middle of a big farm, and it's 200 acres, and we've got a small blueberry patch. And we're kind of surrounded by old-growth forests, so it's almost its own little quarantine. We don't have any fruit flies, so we don't use anything. I'm not relying on this chemical to have my crop. You know, in Margaret River, there's a big group of people that really care about what's on their food. It's, you know, it's a thing to do here. So we've got big farmers markets, and the emphasis is on spray-free and no chemicals. And, I mean, even our kids are asking, like, is this sprayed or non-sprayed? So it's kind of building that awareness around food. So we're super, yeah, we're really interested to grow crops without using chemicals. People don't know. Like, you just go to your supermarket and you're like, oh, yeah, I'm just going to buy whatever I like. And you don't think, hang on a minute, that could be sprayed with whatever chemical. People don't think about it. It's not in their awareness. And they also think that, oh, it's too expensive to buy things that are organic, which it may be more expensive.
What would be your message to people out there buying blueberries right now from their local supermarket?
Find out where your blueberries are from. So, I mean, the best thing is to come out to the farm, pick them from the blueberry bushes yourself and eat them, or take some home. And second best would definitely be buy WA, because if we don't have a fruit fly problem, we don't use the chemical. And if you're going to buy them from somewhere else, wash them. So a simple wash in bicarb when you get home with water, just washing a lot of those pesticides off.
Lorien Blueberry Farm owner Kate Warren, and she was speaking to Rachel Boothman. 29-1, Jonathan Beale is here. He's got the headlines for you.
Thanks, Belinda. The Australia Institute has accused the WA government of altering a secret report to support its assertion that the state's domestic gas production will assist Asia's renewable energy transition. The ABC and The Guardian last week obtained a draft government-commissioned report from consultancy firm Deloitte, which undermined the claim. A final version of the report, tabled in Parliament, projects gas consumption in Asia would increase almost twice as much as forecast in the draft report. Three men involved in a failed housing scheme have pleaded not guilty in a Perth court to various criminal charges, including aiding and abetting a company to engage in dishonest conduct. Sterling Group's founder Raymond Owen Jones, his son Ryan Kentor Jones, and Simon Jasper Bell were charged after an investigation by the Australian Securities and Investments Commission. Sterling collapsed in 2019, leaving investors almost $19 million out of pocket. And the Indonesian President, Prabowo Subianto, has met the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, at Kirribilli House in Sydney as part of a whirlwind visit to Australia. There are a few details about the President's visit, but there is growing speculation the two leaders will make some potentially major announcements later today. Neither leader is expected to take questions from the media. Morning is Belinda at 1 o'clock.
Thank you for the update, Jonathan. Appreciate that. 28-1.
You're with Belinda Varaschetti on the Country Hour on ABC Local Radio WA.
Let's get to some of your thoughts on the wind farm discussion we've been having today. Looking at plans for a big wind farm proposal, the Marri wind farm proposal at Dandaragan. And in response to that, this on the text: if you're fortunate enough to have a large holding of land all in a block and then in the proximity to the three new to be built Western Power transmission lines, then you're in a lucky position financially. If you're the next door neighbour with a small holding, there's a good chance you'll miss out on hosting turbines. So there lies the issue. The bigger farmers get very wealthy, while the smaller farmers look over the fence in envy, which will then lead to anger over not having a big enough property to host turbines. And Deb says, Ree, the wind power, will the farmers be able to bury the turbines when they're at their use-by date? If not, what do they do with them? Who's going to be responsible for the decommissioning of the turbines if the company decides to shut down? And then this from Colin, who thinks nuclear power is the alternative. Where does this money come from? Who's going to clean up when the wind farm runs its time? The text 0448 922 604. Shortly, we're going to have a look at the new pastoral lease conditions, which are expected to be rolled out next year, and then making our way to Katanning for the results of the sheep market just before the news at 1. Right now, to the Bureau of Meteorology, Angeline Prasad is with you this afternoon. What is the story across the Southwest Land Division, Ange?
Good afternoon, Belle. Well, a couple of things are going on today. So we have got the West Coast trough that is finally moving inland. And we also have a very weak cold front that is brushing past the South Coast. So one or two very light showers across the southern coastal districts. But with that West Coast trough moving inland, it is generating very isolated showers and the odd thunderstorm. It is quite dry, so I'm not expecting any or much rainfall, maybe 1 or 2 millimeters. But the main risk is wherever those thunderstorms happen, it might cause lightning strikes. So keep an eye on the radar. So currently, the most likely areas are inland southwest land division, so through the Great Southern Central Wheat Belt and also inland parts of the Central West, extending into the southeast or inland southeast coastal district into this afternoon and evening. Now, following this West Coast trough moving further inland to the Goldfields tomorrow, we will have a ridge developing across southwest WA, so a bit warm today with that West Coast trough moving inland, but this new ridge will bring in milder conditions to much of the southwest land division starting from tomorrow. So initially across the western districts, but as that ridge builds towards the end of the week, we'll see milder conditions prevail across much of the southwest land division. There will be another weak cold front on Friday into Saturday, so that will maintain some very light showers along the southern coastal districts. But apart from that, once the ridge pushes in, we'll see a clearance of weather and milder temperatures. The West Coast trough does return, and it's most likely going to be on Sunday. So that will again start that cycle of a warming trend across much of the southwest land division early next week. So getting quite warm to hot, and it will also bring that risk of or chance of dry thunderstorms as that West Coast trough deepens next week again.
And Ange, I was just having a look at the rainfall figures. There has been a little bit of rain across the Kimberley in the last day. Does that continue across the north and into the eastern part of the state?
Yes, so it is quite warm and moist and humid across the rest of the state through the Gascoyne, northern and eastern parts of the state. And in fact, we have seen thunderstorms firing for much of today across inland parts of the Gascoyne, the northern goldfields, extending to the interior. There's a severe thunderstorm warning out for parts of southern interior, so risk or chance of damaging winds and heavy falls, and also potentially some hail as well. So as that West Coast trough moves inland, we will see a drier flow extend into the Gascoyne and then also into the Western Pilbara over the next couple of days. So we'll see quieter weather or more settled conditions across these areas once the trough moves inland. Elsewhere, we will see those thunderstorms continue, especially through the Goldfields, the interior, the northern and eastern Pilbara, the northern interior, and of course the Kimberley. And it's entirely possible that we could see quite heavy falls isolated. So I'm thinking more sort of in the 20 to 40 millimeters is entirely possible with those thunderstorms, but heavier falls, especially through the deep tropics where the moisture is quite deep, we could see heavier falls, as you've mentioned.
Ange, thank you for going through those details. Appreciate it. It is 22 to 1, and to take a look at the rainfall figures, Kate Forrester is in the studio. Hello.
Hello. Yes, a guest appearance here today. So we're going to start in the Kimberley because, as Ange was just saying, they have had a fair bit of rainfall in the last 24 hours. So we'll start at Dampier Downs Airstrip had 18, Doongan 16, Drysdale River Station 37, Ellen Bray 15, Flora Valley 27, the Gibb River 21, Gogo Station 18, Kachana 25, Kununurra Airstrip 13, Kununurra 55, Leopold Downs 39, Mount Winifred 8, Nicholson 12, Sturt Creek had 12, Tratton Island 19, Windjana Gorge 31, Wyndham 44, and just one area in the Southwest Land Division, Chapman Valley, had 4. Belinda?
Kate, thank you for that. And you're basically taking over the show as of tomorrow.
I'm becoming Belinda Varaschetti. Not forever, though.
So how long are you on for?
I am going to be in the seat until just before Christmas. So spending a lot of time over harvest with farmers and station owners in the north of the state. So I'm really looking forward to it, chatting to everyone and see what they're getting up to for the next month or so.
That'd be great. And I really do appreciate that because that gives me the chance to head overseas.
Yes, and I think you deserve it.
So I'll be having a ball, and I'm really glad the show's going to be in great hands. Thank you for that.
Thanks, Belle.
Kate Forrester here on the Country Hour presenting the show from tomorrow, right up, well, basically up until Christmas time. This is the Country Hour. It's 21 to 1. We'll head to Katanning for the results of the sheep market just before the news at 1 o'clock. First, though, the Department of Lands is expected to roll out new pastoral lease conditions next year under a plan to modernise the state's pastoral leases. The new terms of the lease caused widespread concern within the pastoral industry around this time last year when it came to light that under a new lease, pastoralists will be required to have insurance and lease renewal may trigger native title compensation. Ashley Dowden is the chair of the Pastoralists and Graziers Association Pastoral Committee. He says at this point, the industry is still looking for an ironclad guarantee that native title compensation under the new lease terms will not cost pastoralists money or jeopardise their lease renewal. But he says there has been some real progress on other areas of concern.
Yeah, there's been several developments, some good, some not so good. But I guess on average, we're feeling a little bit more comfortable with what we've been told. We had a briefing update in Kalgoorlie a couple of weeks ago at the GNRBA conference, and also one in Broome, DPLH presented, and Pastoral Lands Board. One of the biggest concern was the insurance, and it's still a concern in as much as there will be significant impost on the pastoralist that now has to carry and indemnify the government. But mm-hmm. a lot of things have been cleared up. We were uncertain whether we had to indemnify every person that came onto the pastoral lease, whether we knew they were there or not. There's been some wording changes in how that's been written up, and we're a lot more comfortable that we're not responsible for someone that we don't know. So if a prospector comes onto the pastoral lease without our permission and we don't know they're there, then, I mean, how could we be liable for them injuring themselves? That's always been our argument, and it's comes to light now that we're probably not. It's until you end up in a court case, I guess, with insurance companies, we're never going to really find out, but it appears as if we are not responsible for that. But there's been some tidy up, some wording changes, and generally speaking, with the insurance, we're a lot more comfortable now than we were 12 months ago.
Do you think the policies, though, will exist? Because that was one of the concerns, the cost of them, but also whether or not insurance companies would be willing to take on the risk that would be associated with the policy. Have you heard from, say, the Insurance Council or something like that, that there is policies to provide the cover that's needed?
Personally, no, but we were assured by DPLH staff that they have been in communication with insurance companies and that there are policies out there to cover what they're asking us to cover. Individual members have said that they've made inquiries and it will be difficult to get that kind of, or those policies, to get that cover. But there are people out there apparently that are prepared at significant cost, I might add, to cover us.
In some of the supporting documents for the draft leases, it said that pastoral lease renewal triggers compensation to native title parties under the Native Title Act. Who will be responsible for any native title compensation? Has that been cleared up? Because that was the other big concern.
And that still is the big concern. We've been assured by departmental staff that the state is responsible for compensation. Now, I haven't seen that, personally haven't seen it written anywhere, but we have been guaranteed by the department that the pastoralist will not be responsible for that compensation. That is the state's responsibility. But my biggest concern is, will that cost then be passed back to the pastoralist? You know, there might be native title holders that claim $1 million or $2 million or $3 million for just, you know, the renewal of a pastoral lease. And if they don't get their money, they might say, well, we're not going to agree to the renewal of the pastoral lease. So the government going to have to put its hand in its pocket for $2 or $3 million to renew the pastoral lease. It may not renew the lease, or it may find some mechanism to recoup that money back from the pastoralist. And that is a huge concern. Although the departmental staff also tell me that there is actually no mechanism for passing on the cost of compensation to a pastoralist. But just because there's no mechanism doesn't mean to say in the future somewhere along the line there won't be a mechanism to do it. And I would be, you know, very concerned anyway. And it still is, that is by far and above away the biggest concern.
Is that something that you'll be seeking some form of ironclad guarantee from the government on, that any compensation cost won't be passed on and that compensation payable won't be an excuse not to renew the lease, that the lease will be renewed?
We will be. That is one of the big sticking points, obviously, that we haven't got clarification on. So we will need some kind of a surety that they won't not renew the lease if there's a huge compensation claim, and also that the costs won't get passed on. I'm not sure if we're going to get that. I wouldn't be confident that any departmental person or the minister would come out and say that that's going to happen, because you won't know what the claims are going to be, how much they're going to be, until it's tested, until the lease comes up for renewal. And it'll depend on what area it is, how many native title holders. You know, there could be four or five claimant groups on one pastoral lease. So there's a lot of unknowns. We will be trying to get some clarity around that and or an assurity, but I'm not confident. I'm really not.
Ashley Dowden from Challa Station, who's also chair of the Pastoralists and Graziers Association Pastoral Committee. He was speaking to Joe Prendergast. All WA leases will expire sometime between 2033 and 2065, and the new lease will then come into effect. On the question of who will ultimately be responsible for any native title compensation costs under a new lease, a Department of Planning, Lands and Heritage spokesperson says pastoral lease renewals are permissible future acts under the Native Title Act, and compensation is payable where native title has been claimed or is determined to exist. The state is the liable party. And the department also says it's anticipated the new standard pastoral lease conditions will be prescribed in regulations under the Lands Administration Act 1997. 14 to 1. A new variety of mango, developed and grown exclusively in far north Queensland, will be available in supermarkets around Australia this summer. The Ruby Gold Mango has been produced in commercial volumes this year after successful market trials. Sophie Johnson has the story.
There is nothing quite like biting into a golden, juicy mango on a hot summer's day. For the first time this year, the new Ruby Gold variety has been produced to commercial volumes. John Nardi is the business manager for tropical fruits with Favco, a family-owned fruit and vegetable wholesaler. He has been working with the Ruby Gold growers, who are based in Dimbula in far north Queensland, about 100 kilometres southwest of Cairns. Mr. Nardi says there are a few things that set these mangoes apart.
Typically has a really nice ruby, maroony sort of maroon sort of blush to it, so it looks fantastic. So when it's ripened, it's got that beautiful blush on a nice sort of yellow-orange background. So really really looks fantastic. And it's just got a really good, strong KP-type flavour, which is what we all love. Typically a bit stronger than normal Kensington Pride, so yeah, it's a little less fibrous as well, so not quite as stringy. So, yeah, you know, it's a fantastic variety. We think it's going to do very well. So far, feedback that we've had from some of the product testing and trialling that we've done has been amazing. So, yeah, we think it'll do really well in the market. And, yeah, it'll be a great new thing for mango lovers.
The Ruby Gold came about naturally on farm. And for the past decade, Mr. Nardi has helped the growers, the Palumbo family, to develop the variety.
So when the growers identified the variety, it was different. My understanding is it was pretty much just a branch on a normal Kensington Pride tree, a random branch that had this slightly different looking fruit. It was with a bit more blush and it had a slightly stronger flavour. It's a typical Kensington Pride shape as well that we're used to as Australians, so it does look very familiar in that respect. They then worked in taking grafts off that branch and then producing more trees, and yeah, they've just grown with it from there. They've got it registered, so it has got plant breeders' rights, so it is identified as its own variety. It has been different enough to be called its own variety, so, yeah, it has its own PBR, is what we call it, for plant breeders' rights, and, yeah, it's grown over the years from there. They're getting They've got more plantings in the ground and starting to enter into some semi-commercial volumes this year.
The Ruby Gold Mango is a premium product, and with 15,000 trays expected this season, marketing agents are getting excited, like Peter Tran, who is a Melbourne-based agent and director of Produce of Virginia.
Well, I'll do a bit of business with Favco, just marketing their KPs and their R2E2s as well. And when they mentioned that there was a new variety coming through the market that they wanted to try and trial in Melbourne, I was more than keen to put my hand up and give it a crack.
Over the past 2 years, he has been a part of Mr. Nardi's trials, bringing smaller amounts of the Ruby Gold variety to independent supermarkets and retailers. He says consumers can't get enough of it, but he's not surprised. He says he knew it was going to be a high-performing variety from the first batch.
Oh, well, the first pallet that arrived, when me and my staff took down a tray, I was blown away by the blush on the skin. It was incredible. Every single piece had this beautiful ruby blush. And once we put it into the ripening rooms, and after 3 or 4 days checking up on the fruit, the golden colour of the skin really popped, really contrasted with the ruby gold blush. It was amazing. And once we had a taste of it, I was like, this is a winner. This can't be beaten. There are some things you just know as an agent, you know what will sell, what will do well, what will do badly. But this variety of mango, when we saw it, we were like, yep, that's a winner.
Mr. Tran says the fruit has a number of attractive features.
It holds very well. It's similar to an R2E2 in terms of shelf life and firmness of flesh, but also with the benefits of being a KP genetic, it tastes even better than a KP. So the best of both worlds. Just looking at the fruit and just feeling the firm flesh, you know that their shelf life is probably at least 50% longer than the KPs.
Picking for this season's crop is underway this week, with the fruit expected to hit supermarket shelves soon after.
That report from Sophie Johnson. And if you want to read more about it, it's online for you. Just search ABC Rural and Ruby Gold and you'll find Sophie's story there. 8:01. Conservation dogs are being deployed across the Lower Murray River in South Australia's Riverland region to sniff out freshwater turtle nests in an effort to protect the troubled species. Native freshwater turtle populations have declined up to 91% across the Lower Murray in the past 40 years. Conservation dog handler Fiona Jackson says even though they are still in the training stages of the program, she's quietly confident it will have a successful outcome because it's already worked in other states, like here in Western Australia.
It takes a bit of work, but what we're doing with our three dogs here is we're getting substrate from the natural environment and adding some colloquial fluid, some turtle fluid to the substrate and training with the dogs that anytime they sniff out that odour, they get rewarded. So anytime they sniff out, they get rewarded with either a little bit of food or their absolute favourite thing, which is a ball.
Why are they such a good tool in the detection process?
Dogs in general as a methodology, because of their sense of smell, it's just so incredible. People say it's researchers say it's anywhere between 10,000 and 100,000 times better than our sense of smell. So anything that we're struggling to find in the natural environment, like turtle nests, you can deploy a dog. That technology of their sense of smell can be a real aid in finding those nests or anything that's really difficult for us as humans, either as spotters or other methodologies that struggles.
How effective are they in finding the nests? I know it's a relatively new process.
Yeah, so we are still training. We've just started this week. Actually, in fact, last week we just introduced the dogs to the odour. So the training wheels are very much still on for our three. But that being said, there's other groups around Australia and across the world who have done this successfully, so it can be done. People up in New South Wales, over in Western Australia, and even in Victoria, actually, who have all successfully worked with conservation detection dogs to find turtle nests. So we're confident that once our lot are trained up, they'll be able to do the same and help out here.
How long is that training process?
In terms of scent imprinting the dog on the odour, it takes a couple of weeks. Then you've got to get the dog out, which is what we're doing this week, is get the dog out in the natural environment, get them used to this environment, and it's then becomes becomes very much a process of calibrating the dog across all the different odour possibilities and complexities that there are in the natural environment. So it's hard to say, but in terms of if you have a brand new dog, if you have a dog from pup, it can take anywhere to 12 months to 18 months to get a dog up and running. But thankfully, the dogs that we've put on this project are already experienced. So they have all their safety and welfare instructions in place. So they're very safe in the natural environment, which is super important to us. So we're hoping after a month or two of training on this odour specifically, that they'll be ready and really calibrated to the odour to help and do searches in the natural environment here.
And tell us about the dogs involved. Who are they and how successful have they been so far in getting that imprint?
So the dogs, we've got three dogs on this project. Two very experienced dogs who are called Oakley and Rex, who are actually out with us in South Australia at the minute because they're also on the Murray Darling Carpet Python project, which is what we've been doing this morning. And they're super experienced dogs and have quite a few different threatened species odours that they're already on. And they are scent imprinting now to three different turtle species, so the broad shell, the eastern long neck, and the Murray short neck. And then we've got a slightly younger dog, Aaron, who's 3 years old. This is his first threatened species project, but he's very experienced and helps us out in our renewable energy projects. And he is also just absolutely nailing his scent imprinting. So we're really excited to take these training odours that we have and start putting them out here where we are at the minute down by the lake, and having him and the other two go out and start searching around here.
They are doing very important jobs, aren't they? Conservation dog handler Fiona Jackson, and she was speaking to Anita Ward. 4 minutes to one here on the Country Hour. We'll head off to Katanning right after this.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today. Victoria seeks adult jail sentences for children aged 14 and over who commit serious violent crimes. The Federal Liberal Party gathers to discuss their net zero policy by 2050. Reports that the UK has stopped sharing intelligence with the US over possible strikes on Venezuela. And a world record attempt for the most number of bagpipers in Melbourne with an AC/DC twist. Those stories and more. Join me for The World Today.
Let's head to Katanning now. And the total yarding today was 13,108 sheep and lambs at the Katanning market today, and that is up 593 on last week's numbers. Tracy Kilner has been at the sale today, keeping an eye on proceedings. Tracy, hello. Can you run through the details?
An improved quality yarding saw a higher number of lambs offered, with stores and lightweights gaining with processor and restocker feeder competition, while the extra heavyweights eased with reduced demand. Large lines of merino ewes once again dominated the grown sheep yarding, with all weight categories gaining. The new season lambs weighing under 16 kilos, carcass weight sold from 120 to 172, heavier lambs made from 160 to 193, trade weight lambs sold from 190 to 223, and the heavyweights from $217 up to $250 a head for extra heavyweights. Merino store weather hoggets ranged from 80 to 142, medium and heavyweights sold from 150 to 244, Merino ewe hoggets returned from 50 to 180 for lightweights, medium and heavyweights made from 160 up to 251 with restocker competition. Store mutton sold from 50 to 180 for the large frame ewes carrying a fleece. The prime medium weight ewes returned from 160 to 214, and heavyweight ewes over 30 kilos carcass weight sold from 199 up to $250 a head. The mature store weathers made from 130 to 154, medium and heavyweights returned 175 to 230, mature rams sold from 60 to 160 with increased demand from processors, live export and restocker buyers. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Tracy, thank you for those details. A minute and a half away from the news at one, a lot of you keen to have your say on the wind farm proposal at Dandaragan, 160 kilometres north of Perth. This is the 82-turbine Marie Wind Farm. Richard, who lives in the area, says, I'm a landholder of a property that neighbours the Marie Wind Farm. In my opinion, Alinta has been very good in dealing with us and generous too. The farmers with wind turbines and their properties are set to make very good money from the wind farm over the next 30 years. If they want to put turbines on my property, I'd say they're more than welcome. Personally, I don't understand all the negativity around wind farms. I think it's a positive for everyone involved. Plus, I don't think they're ugly. I think they're a marvel of human innovation. Thank you, Richard. This too from another local. Just wondering, what is the local shire justification for getting so much money? If the roads used by the wind farm company are repaired and potentially improved, why is there extra money demanded by the local shire? The wind farm companies make substantial donations to local community groups. So is this another greedy government move by the Dandaragan Shire? And that text through from Michael. And just finally, it's a real shame seeing Australia being ruined with so-called renewable power while we export our cheap coal for cheap power to overseas countries. It is a con job. Thank you, Sebastian. News time, it's 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.